Cartoons are pretty common nowadays, and most people probably credit the Beatles for the creation of the phenomenon. But some people remember the Monkees, a group often referred to as the Prefab Four, a U.S. pop band that was created in 1968 for a television show of the same name that originally aired for two seasons, and then went on to become a legitimate pop band in its own right. Welcome to Late Edition Crime Beat Chronicles, a Lee Enterprises podcast. I'm Amber Moten, the show's producer and editor, back with another story that you may not think of as a traditional true crime case. Okay, the band. It consisted of Mickey Dolenz, Davy Jones, Michael Nesmith, and Peter Tork. The show played well to both fans and critics and performed well in its original run and through syndication and Saturday morning repeats. The show is a scripted comedy all about the four bandmates struggling to make it in the music business, and of course, the hijinks that ensued. While a manufactured band, the music really did catch on, and they eventually toured to sold-out crowds. Okay, but how did the creators of Daydream Believer and I'm a Believer, a song brought back into the lexicon by the band Smash Mouth for the Shrek soundtrack, land themselves the subject of a true crime podcast? Well, would you be surprised to learn that the Monkees were the subject of an FBI investigation? The group's final surviving member, Mickey Dolenz, sued the FBI in 2022 to obtain any files on him, the band, and his bandmates after submitting a Freedom of Information Act request in June of that year and failing to receive anything more than an automated response within the 20 days that federal agencies are obligated to respond. Randy Crable, you may remember him from the series of episodes we did with the Tulsa World about the Osages during the Reign of Terror, joins me in this episode to explain how the pop band came to the attention of the FBI and, of course, the tie to Tulsa.
It is great to have you back on the podcast, so thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
You wrote an article about the Monkees, the band, and a tie to the FBI, but let's kind of start a little bit with who the Monkees were. Now, I remember them when I was little. I think around when I was 4, MTV was airing reruns of their TV show, which was a sitcom, if I remember correctly, and I absolutely adored it. Can you just kind of talk about the history of the Monkees?
Sure. So I was kind of the Monkees' target audience, I think, when they came out. But in the 1960s, when the we had the British invasion and sort of pop music and rock music was really exploding onto the scenes, and TV producers got the idea of creating a band and making a television series about the band. And initially, the band was not going to be performing their own music. I think the idea was they actually would do the singing, but not play the instruments. And the show turned out to be like a lot of music in that era. The band became rapidly popular and almost as rapidly faded from the scene, but at any rate, they became proficient enough, I guess you would say. Basically, they just insisted that they were going to be the band, that they didn't need all these other people. So they went out on tour. They had at least a couple of them, they had more than that, I think. But they went out on tour, and they were, you know, quite successful. Like, I found out they sold something like 75 million records in about a 2 or 3 year span. So they were pretty much a big deal. Because it was put together by these TV producers, they hired some of the big name songwriters in the Brill Building in New York, which was, the place where a lot of the 50s and 60s and on into the 70s, big hits were written in the Brill Building in New York. And so they had some very big hits. And then you mentioned MTV. They had kind of a second life when MTV came out, because they started playing those shows in reruns and they became popular again. And at least some of them started touring again in the, I guess it was in the 80s, maybe. And even there's one of them still alive, Mickey Dolenz, and he still does some shows at 78.
Or didn't the show actually win an Emmy, I think?
Yeah, I think one year the show won an Emmy for Best Comedy Series. It beat out like Andy Griffith and some shows like that.
So, I mean, it was legitimately entertaining, it sounds like, and critically acclaimed. So,
well, it was different because they, as I recall, they would come out and there were sort of plots, but it was almost kind of an absurdist comedy in that they were kind of goofy and they were just a lot of little series of scenes. And some people have drawn a line from that show to music videos in the, you know, in the MTV era, because the you know, it was set up to kind of sell the music, and it all revolved around their music. I mean, the plot, such as they were pretty simple and silly, intentionally silly, I should say.
Right, right. Okay, so let's set up the crime in air quotes here. So the Monkees were in Tulsa. You said they were touring. They were in Tulsa in 1967 to play a concert. Can you kind of set the scene with that?
Yeah, they came. It was actually on January the 2nd, 1967. They played at what was then called the Convention Center Arena. It was a downtown venue that had not been open very long at that time. It would hold about 8,500 people for a concert like this, and they sold out. It was mainly like young teens, I think, you know, probably, you know, 11 or 12 up to 16, 17, something like that, and their parents. Some mom would get roped into bringing, you know, five or six kids from the neighborhood or whatever. And it, you know, it went on. There was no big controversy, I don't think, at the time, except this entertainment writer, editor from the Tulsa Tribune, which was an afternoon paper here at the time. He didn't like it. And one of the criticisms in general of the Monkees was that some people called them the Prefab Four, because they were created specifically for television. It wasn't a group of guys who just kind of came together and started making music together. They were created, and some people didn't like that. And their music was not intended to be, for the most part, real, you know, deep and social meaning or anything like that. So anyway, he didn't like it. He wrote a letter to the FBI. Well, it's not clear to me in the report. It's not clear whether he wrote directly to the FBI. Apparently, he maybe sent this to the television production, the television studio, complaining that they were projecting subliminal messages onto a screen behind them during one of the songs, which is one of the things, if you weren't around in the 60s, that there was all kinds of stuff like that in the 60s and the early 70s. You know, if you play Beatles records backwards, they had some kind of message in them. Or, you know, there was the big set, a lot of radio stations and so forth wouldn't play Louie Louie by the Kingsmen because no one could understand the lyrics, but they were pretty sure they were bad. So they didn't understand. It was just a very poor recording. But he complained to the FBI. I don't know that the FBI really took it that seriously, because as I wrote in the story, they had the guy who complained, his name was Bill Donaldson. So they had his name wrong in their report. They had his newspaper wrong in the report, and they had the date of the concert wrong in their report. But what happened was someone a few months later compiled all of that into a bigger report. Is like 80 pages long, on the influence of communism and subversive groups on Hollywood. And so that was included in there. And, you know, I don't think anything came of it, but if I could, I mean, this is all kind of fun, but on the other hand, it does make people kind of stop and think. It should make people kind of stop and think about, well, what does it take to get, you know, to have a FBI file? Apparently not very much.
Right. What was the political climate like back then?
Yeah, it was a lot of turmoil. And so what, and in this particular case, what they had done, they had a song that did try and, it was called I Want to Be Free. It did try and have a little bit of a social message. And they were showing, there was nothing subliminal about this. They were showing images of riots and the war in Vietnam and peace marches, and I think they had something on the I think there were scenes from the Selma, Alabama march, which had actually taken place, you know, several years earlier, but at any rate, was still very much in the news. And so it wasn't really subliminal. It was stuff they'd see on the news every day. But the bigger picture was that, yes, there was a lot of turmoil. There was a lot of opposition to the war in Vietnam. There was, you know, it was the 60s. It was the protest era. There were quite a few violent demonstrations, and there was a lot of concern about the communists taking over. So a lot of this file was, there was a radio station in Los Angeles that would from time to time have members of the American Communist Party on to talk. And they would mention that so-and-so, who's now a very well-known personality or producer, had dinner with so-and-so. And back in 1938, they attended a dinner at a known communist's. You know, things like that. For some reason, it mentioned Robert Vaughn quite a bit. And people may not remember Robert Vaughn, but he was a popular actor in the 60s. He was one of the Magnificent Seven in the movie The Magnificent Seven. And then later, he starred in a TV show called The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which kind of had a cult following. And you know, he was always popping up at some kind of demonstration or something like that. So it was a very tumultuous time. Also, the FBI was run by J. Edgar Hoover, who liked to get as much dirt as he could on as many people as he could. So that may have had something to do with it. I don't know.
We have to take a quick break, so don't go too far.
You said that Donaldson had accused the band of deliberate manipulation or a preconditioned immature audience for propaganda dissemination. And you mentioned that it wasn't in any way subliminal, like the message they were getting across in their one potentially political song was pretty obvious. But do you think he was just reading into things because he didn't like the music or...
Well, so Bill Donaldson, and I didn't know him. He was still at the, so the Tribune closed in 1992, and I started here before that. And I was at the World when he was at the Tribune, but I don't think our paths ever crossed. He was part of that older generation. He was a World War II veteran. You know, patriotism was very big. He had an English literature degree from Swarthmore. First of all, I don't think he cared that he didn't like the music that much. But second of all, he didn't like the idea of this sort of manufactured, he called it manufactured hysteria or manufactured emotion. He didn't like that. So I think he felt like, you know, these young people were being manipulated, and, you know, probably to a certain extent they were. But nobody after the concert was over went out and started trying to burn the city down or anything like that. It was mostly just fun. And so I think to a large extent it was, I can remember some of my own dad when I was a kid and that show was on. We were not supposed to watch it just because it wasn't that he was, it made him mad or anything. He just, it's a stupid show.
Yeah.
He had a category of television program. That's just a stupid show. And so we didn't watch it. And I think, there's that category.
I wonder what Donaldson would think about, you know, like the Swifties and, you know, of course, the boy band fans of, you know, like NSYNC.
No, I think he'd be appalled. He had a background in the theater. He had performed in the theater here and run a theater in Tulsa for a while. And, you know, I mean, I just think that would be something. Although, you know, I mean, he would have gone through the period when he would have gone through the Elvis Presley period. He would have gone through the Frank Sinatra period when, for even someone my age, Frank Sinatra was always kind of the older guy. But there was a period in the 50s and 60s when, you know, girls would swoon over Frank Sinatra. So anyway, you know, he knew a little bit about that and acknowledged it, but he just thought this was too fake, too phony, that these guys had done nothing to deserve the adoration and attention they were getting, and that whoever had created this group was using this group to warp the minds of America's youth.
Fair enough. May not be entirely wrong, but I think it was probably more to sell albums and TV shows and tickets as opposed.
Right. It was to make money. That's all I cared about, you know. And I have to say that, you know, there maybe was a little bit of anti-Semitism involved. The Monkees weren't Jewish, mm-hmm. but the producer, so the one of the producers was the son of the head of one of the studios in Los Angeles. And they seem to have been Jewish. And so, you know, I don't know, but there could have been some anti-Semitism involved in that, too. Gotcha. I mean, you saw that these guys were all white. But, you know, with some of the black performers at the time, it was really evident, you know. And so, I mean, this is getting a little far field, but some people think that President Nixon pushed for the criminalization for marijuana because he believed he associated it with black performers in music genres that he didn't understand or didn't approve of. And so he wanted to put those guys in jail.
Okay. So you said you didn't think that the FBI really gave it much attention. You mentioned like the misspellings and inaccuracies in the report. Did it give you any indication that they actually followed up and looked into it?
Well, so I didn't see this report, but the lawyer, Mr. Zaid, who's the lawyer for Mickey Dolenz, said that there was another report where an FBI agent went to one of the concerts. And it's not clear whether he went because of this report or he went because he had a 12-year-old daughter. But anyway, he went and said more or less the same thing that Bill Donaldson did.
I fully admit I really wanted to do this because anytime I can talk about Daydream Believer, it makes me happy. my mom said I would run around screaming the lyrics to that song when I was little. So that was always fun. But I mean, is the general consensus does not seem to be that the Monkees were some big subversive group. Is that right?
Correct. But I will say, again, it shows you how, you know, it's easy to get on someone's the FBI or whoever's list. You know, you think about, we have these terrorism watch lists now where if your name is close enough to somebody else, you can be in trouble. I mean, so the attorney is also representing the actor from Two and a Half Men, John. I can't think of Breyer? John's last. John, yeah, yeah. So he'd met him and John Cryer, and John Cryer said, "Well, I don't think I've got anything, but my uncle was an anti-war activist, and we'd kind of like to know if he has anything." So the lawyer put in a request for, you know, this man's file. Well, it turned out it was like 3,000 pages long.
Holy cow.
And I don't know that he was a particularly prominent. I mean, it's not like he was Abby Hoffman or something.
Right.
But they've got 3,000 pages on him. So, and it can be kind of a long, protracted thing to get these. Because according to the lawyer, they will only process 500 pages a month on any one request.
Oh Oh, gee. So,
yeah, right. And so, and then when you get it, it may be all redacted and you've got to go to court to have the redactions removed. So, I mean, I don't want people in a panic or anything like that, but I think they ought to be aware that, you know, there is a lot of information out there and, you know, some people don't like that.
Yeah.
I don't have good answers, but obviously in this case, it's difficult. It really is. And, you know, this doesn't help the average person, but if they are interested in some of these better known FBI files, they are available online. You can go look up. I mentioned Abbie Hoffman. You can go read mm-hmm. Abbie Hoffman's file online if you want.
That's pretty much everything I had. Is there anything I didn't ask you about that you really want to make sure we get in there?
You know, this is kind of one of those deals where we got the email from the lawyer, and when we first looked at it, we thought, oh, what the heck is this? And then the more we thought about it and the more we got into it, it was, you know, it's one of those things that's fun and people seem to be interested in it. But at the same time, it does sort of illustrate a bigger issue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You could be on a list and you don't know it, or, you know, like how easy is it to just suggest something and have it make it onto some FBI agent's desk?
And nowadays with the digitization of everything, once you're in there, there's no telling where it's not quite as bad as Twitter or mm-hmm. X.
Yeah, no, completely agree. Well, thank you. That's all I've got.
I always enjoy talking to you.
It should be noted that there were multiple musical artists in that era who were known to be tracked by the FBI. Artists that the group interacted with, including the Beatles and Jimi Hendrix. So the Monkees are far from the only musical act to catch the attention of the federal government, but this was still a pretty interesting story. That'll do it for this week's episode of Crime Beat Chronicles. Make sure you hit that subscribe button so you don't miss what we have coming up next. Thanks for listening.